from the American College of Cardiology. This is Dr. Kim Eagle with Eagle's Eye View. This is your editor-in-chief's weekly update of ACC.org and key articles that are coming out each and every week. I'm recording this podcast on Monday, November 4th, 2019. I've chosen three articles today that were published just in the past week. One deals with a look at the ACCHA HRS versus ESC guidelines for the diagnosis and management of syncope and compares those two guidelines. Another's a paper that came out of JAC looking at distinct subgroups with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in the NHLBI HCM registry. And finally, an interesting paper that was published looking at different types of antihypertensive therapies, first-line therapies. It's a comprehensive comparative effectiveness analysis. So let's begin with syncope. As you probably know, the ACCHA HRS released syncope guidelines in 2017 and then the ESC in 2018. And I wanted to talk about this paper published in JAC, which looks at the differences between these two documents. So there are several differences that are notable in patients with conduction disease, reflex syncope, and orthostatic hypotension. Of course, many of the treatment recommendations overall are the same. But let's talk about conduction disease. In the European guidelines, there are discrete recommendations regarding patients with conduction disease versus the U.S. The U.S. guidelines offer a Class 1 recommendation for guideline-directed medical therapy for syncope due to bradycardia, but the European guidelines, in contrast, offer several recommendations for pacing in conduction system disease. And the European guidelines are slightly less supportive of empiric pacing in patients with syncope and bifascicular block. They give that a 2B. They give a Class 1 recommendation for pacing with EPS-guided therapy. The European guidelines also offer several specific recommendations for EP study, and they present actually four specific recommendations for EP study and EP-guided therapy. The European guidelines favor EPS study in patients with an ischemic substrate, syncope with bifascicular block, that's a class 2A, or syncope accompanied by sinus bradycardia or palpitation, that would be a 2B, in patients whose syncope remains unexplained after non-invasive evaluation. In contrast, the use of EPS is more broadly addressed in the U.S. guidelines. Another striking discrepancy between the two syncope guidelines is the recommendations for beta blockers for the treatment of reflex syncope. The European guidelines basically say that's class 3, don't do it, stating there's no indication for beta blockers in reflex syncope. The U.S. guidelines, in contrast, state that beta blockers might be reasonable in a patient at least 42 years of age, and they give it a class 2B. Another difference is that the European guidelines provide class 2B recommendation for pacing in patients older than 70 with tilt-induced asystolic response and frequent unpredictable recurrent syncope, and in patients with clinical features of adenosine-sensitive syncope, and this does not have a direct parallel correlation in the U.S. guidelines. The European guidelines recommend patient education and reassurance for orthostatic hypotension, while the U.S. guidelines recommend water ingestion for neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. And of course, this difference may be in part related to the fact that they slightly differed in their definition of neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. Both guidelines talk about the needs for studies aimed at understanding the underlying causes of syncope and the need for better diagnostic devices, potentially the use of wearable devices to evaluate syncope. But I think overall that the guidelines, of course, are very informative and can help guide our practice. But I wanted to bring attention to you about a few of the differences that do exist between the U.S. and the European guidelines. Let's move to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. This week in JAC, a terrific paper looking at distinct subgroups of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy as studied in the NHLBI HCM registry. This registry has over 2,700 patients in it, accrued from 44 sites in six countries in North America and Europe. The age range is 18 to 65. They have an established diagnosis of HCM. Patients with prior septal interventions, coronary disease, or clinically important ventricular arrhythmias were excluded. And the baseline study includes echo data, stress testing data, Holter monitor, the European Society of Cardiology risk score. Cardiac MR was performed, using CINE imaging for morphologic assessment, late gadolinium enhancement and T1 mapping for extracellular volume, giving markers of replacement and interstitial fibrosis. Also, serum markers were drawn, including troponin T and NT-proBNP, and genetic analysis, too, including core sarcomeric and well-established phenocopy genes. So the results look at 2,755 patients. 71% were male, 84% white, 37% had hypertension, and 33% had a family history of HCM. Overall, the echo data set a maximal mean wall thickness of 18.6 millimeters. Only 18% had a peak gradient over 30, and those had an average gradient that was a whopping 69 plus or minus 31. Holter showed atrial fibrillation in 4% and non-sustained VT in 12%. Stress testing showed a hypotensive response in just 12%. The mean ESC risk score was 2.5, basically. In genetic analysis, about 30% had a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant of a sarcomere gene, and the most common variants were MYBC3 in 18% or MYH7 in 8%. Cardiac MR identified six morphologic subtypes, and they are isolated basal septal hypertrophy in 46%, reverse septal curvature in 40%, apical HCM 9%, and mid-cavity obstruction with apical aneurysm in 3%, and then concentric LVH in just 1%. 1% were designated as other. Late gadolinium enhancement was present in 50%. That was greatest in those with reverse septal curvature hypertrophy. 43 of 46 such patients had an LGE mass greater than 15%. Patients who had isolated basal septal hypertrophy had less late gadolinium enhancement and less evidence of extracellular volume than other morphologies. 58% of sarcomere mutation positive patients had reverse septal curvature morphology, and 34% had isolated basal septal hypertrophy, whereas the frequency were reversed for sarcomere mutation negative patients, 31 and 52%. Surprisingly, a smaller number of patients with sarcomere mutation positive had LVOT gradients greater than 30, 19% overall versus 27% of the rest. So there are several conclusions. The first, I think, is that two relatively distinct populations emerged from this very wonderful analysis. Patients positive for a sarcomere mutation were on average younger, more often female and white, had a lower BMI, less hypertension, and they were more likely to have a family history of HCM. Of course, this group then represents the Mendelian form of familial HCM. And they were more likely to have reverse septal curvature morphology, more fibrosis, and less significant LVOT obstruction. In the patients who were negative for sarcomere mutation, who were on average older, more often male, had a higher BMI and more hypertension, and this group was more likely to have isolated basal septal hypertrophy, less fibrosis, and more LVOT obstruction. This is a powerful study, and it starts to incorporate biomarker data and more sensitive imaging into creating phenotypes. Now, of course, the next step is to ask the question, okay, if we can phenotype more accurately, how does then this get translated into the therapies? And should we use ongoing analyses of imaging and biomarkers to gauge response to therapy and risk? This is a really excellent study. I recommend it to you. And certainly, we're on our way to learning more about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and its treatment. The last paper I want to mention was a paper that looked at comprehensive comparative effectiveness and safety analysis of first-line antihypertensive therapy drug classes. This comes from a study called LEGEND-HTN, LEGEND Hypertension, and it's an international group that's providing a comprehensive framework for real-world evidence that allows one to look at comparative effectiveness and safety across many drugs and outcomes, potentially encompassing millions of patients. And this one was looking at the relative risks of three primary endpoints: acute MI, hospitalization for heart failure and stroke, and six secondary effectiveness and 46 safety outcomes, comparing first-line antihypertensive drugs in a global network. And they were divided into the thiazide group, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors, ARBs, the dihydropyridine calcium blockers, and the non-dihydropyridine calcium blockers. And the framework included assessment of residual confounding, publication bias, and was very carefully done. So they had 4.9 million patients, and they created a number of propensity score adjusted hazard ratios to look at the various classes of drugs for primary prevention. Most of the estimates revealed no effectiveness difference between classes, but thiazide diuretics showed better primary effectiveness than ACE inhibitors. For acute MI, the hazard ratio 0.84, hospitalization for heart failure 0.83, and stroke 0.83. Safety profiles also favored thiazide diuretics over angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors. The non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers appear to be significantly inferior to the other classes. Those were the main conclusions. So certainly, in general, this wonderful paper, sophisticated analysis, does support equivalence between the drug classes for initiating monotherapy for hypertension. And in keeping with the current guidelines, the recommendation for thiazide or thiazide-like drugs is superior, particularly in this analysis, to ACE inhibitors and probably the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Obviously, when you do studies like this of massive numbers of patients and databases, the possibility of uncontrolled bias emerges. But I do think as we move in the era of big data, we're going to find that these types of analyses are informative to us as we strive to do a better job of identifying first-line therapy for diseases like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, etc. Well, I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. We talked today about syncope, about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and the treatment of hypertension. You can find these journal scans and their related links to articles on acc.org. Also, you'll find our educational catalog under Education and Meetings. This tool can help you sort your educational offerings by various formats, and of course, most of these are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And this is Kim Eagle from acc.org, thanking you for listening to this Eagle's Eye View, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. I hope you have a good one. Thank you.